Osiris.
Give it to me, say it to me, work it with me. If you're ready, I'm about to pop.
David Goldstein.
I am Brian Brinkman.
And I am Jake Cohen.
You are tuned in to episode 45 of the Beyond the Pond podcast. This is the podcast which, generally speaking, Brian and myself, and tonight, Jake, utilize the music of fish as a Trojan horse of sorts, as a means of getting the listener to listen to other bands. These are generally non-jam bands. Because we love fish, we are fish fans. Sometimes the problem with fish fans is they got one-track minds. They get a bit myopic. They only listen to fish. They can recount set lists at the drop of a hat and pick up big copies of the Helping Friendly book and just go crazy with fish and not realize there's so many other bands out there. We're going to do something about it.
Absolutely. We are here coming to you in our 45th episode to talk about one of my favorite jams, a formative jam in my fandom for fish. I think for all of us, I think for all of you guys listening, one of the best jams the band has ever played. I'm talking about none other than the AC/DC Bag from Boise, Idaho on September 14th, 1999. Just an unbelievable jam. For anyone who's coming at us late, who has not listened to much Beyond the Pond, just as a quick overview of what we do, we're going to take the AC/DC Bag. We're going to break this down into a couple of our favorite segments, dissect it, nerd out on it, talk about what was happening on the tour, what may have led to this. And then we're going to splinter off, talk about a few other bands and artists that we think that you guys would really enjoy based on themes that we've come up with about this jam.
Some of the themes we're going to explore in this episode include familiar themes in the minor key, dark minor key synths with watery effect guitar leads, and big fat disco parties. But we've got a guest in this episode, and we're going to talk to him just now. This is Jake Cohen. You may know him on Twitter at Meaningless Excitement. He's an intelligent guy. He's a musicologist. He's a very focused fish fan. And
it's actually at... it's at Smooth Atonal Sound.
Oh, that's correct. The,
yeah, but I just pop up on everybody's Twitter feed as Meaningless Excitement. So
that's right. It is Smooth Atonal. That is at Smooth Atonal Sound.
That's okay. Correct. And because of Twitter's limitations on at handle characters, it's SND. So at Smooth Atonal SND.
Smooth Atonal SND.
You can all be sure that we'll put this in the show notes. You can all be sure of that.
Yes. And it is a private... yeah, I was going to say, it's a private account, but if you have anything that even remotely tips your hat as to your love of this music, then you get a follow request approved.
As to your very heady inclinations. But this is great, because we've actually wanted to have Jake on for a long time. It's been in the works. We finally were able to fit it into our very oh-so-busy schedules. So,
and as soon as you asked me to be on the show, the first jam I thought of was, let's do the Boise Bag.
And I think we were like, everyone knows the Boise Bag. But then you pitched it to us, and we're like, oh, okay, that's a pretty cool presentation. Fuck yeah, let's do it.
Absolutely. So, Jake, coming at us, what was your introduction to fish? Like, how did this whole journey start for you?
Well, I got, like so many middle-class Jewish kids from the Northeast, I went to Jewish summer camp and all my counselors were deadheads. And that is how I got into the Grateful Dead originally at a very young age, because all my counselors were deadheads. And I remember the moment very specifically when I first heard Terrapin Station coming out of my counselor's stereo and was just drawn to it like a moth to the light. And a few years later, I got into Phish, and I had sort of been aware of them because other counselors there had been into them as well, but it had never really clicked for me. Summer of 1996, my counselor, who was a taper, an old school Phish taper as well, a guy named Mark Goldberg, he sat me down and he played me the tape that he had recorded of the 7894 Game Henge show from Great Woods, the last Game Henge.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And he kind of explained, you know, he sort of Sherpa'd me through the mythology and the lore. And I remember it was like a rainy day, so there was no activities that day. And it was just, I kind of fell in love with it, you know, lizards immediately sort of, you know, jumped out at me, and played that tape endlessly. I only had the first set. I only listened to the first set of that tape. And, you know, eventually I got a live one. I got some other tapes. I got some other albums. And then my first show was a year later at the Worcester Centrum. It was the 11/29/97, the Runaway Jam with the 59-minute Runaway Jam.
Wow.
Yep. And I had no idea what was happening. Yeah.
No, I can't imagine you would.
No, I had no idea that.
What were your thoughts?
I had no idea that anything out of the ordinary was happening. You know, it was like,
okay.
Yeah, I was like, I could tell it was long, but you know, people around me were losing their minds, and I was like, okay, all right.
It's funny. So I'm not Jewish. I did not go to Jewish summer camp, but I did go to summer camp in the Midwest, and I discovered Phish in the exact mm-hmm. same manner. I had a camp counselor who went on summer and fall 97 tour, and passed me along a number of tapes and took me to see Trey at Alpine. And it's like, that's the indoctrination. Like, I wonder what my parents would say if they could look in hindsight and be like, we shouldn't have sent this kid to summer camp.
I'm glad to hear that it's not limited to one particular denomination or religion. All American summer camps are into indoctrinating.
So Jake, do you have a like favorite show and a particular era of Phish?
My favorite era sort of depends on my mood. I love 2003 because I did that whole summer tour and I saw 27 shows that year. So,
damn.
Yeah, I'm kind of, you know, that was the summer right after I graduated college. So I was primed for some strong 2.0 touring. But, you know, 94, 93, 97, 99, I love them all. I'd say if I had to pick a single favorite show, hard pressed, I would say Binghamton 95, 12/14/95. Mostly
flawless.
Yeah, mostly because of the Haley's NICU Slave. Just the jam in and out of NICU is like one of my favorite things. So
it's also friend of the pond and one time guest Josh Carver's favorite Phish show for that same reason.
Yep, it is. It is. And
Noah Sox.
Andy Hollander also went to I think he went to school in Binghamton, so he talks a lot about that show.
When you're not listening to Phish, what do you got on?
Well, I do listen to the good old Grateful Dead somewhat frequently. This summer we kind of wore out the Garcia Band Cats Under the Stars album.
Yacht Rock Jerry.
Oh yeah, so good. So good. My theory is that Cats Under the Stars is actually a Donna album with it's a Donna side project featuring Jerry.
That's basically. It's definitely some of the foxiest Donna moves on that album.
Yes. Recently I've been listening to a lot of indie folk and Americana kind of recordings. I've been really into This Is the Kit, Decemberists, Dobro player named Charlie Parr, Offa Rex, I also listen to a lot of contemporary classical music, sort of related to my profession. So I'm really into some, you know, composers who are still alive and kicking and making amazing music these days, like Missy Mazzoli, John Luther Adams, Marcos Balter, Caroline Shaw, Hannah Lash, Ashley Fury, Steve Reich. And I also listen to a lot of 20th century American classical composers who do weird stuff, like Charles Ives, Aaron Copland, Ruth Crawford Seeger, William Grant Still, Julius Eastman, and others. So pretty eclectic. I listen to a lot of stuff. So
you got a pretty diverse listening base here. What are some of your favorite shows, albums that you've heard or seen here in 2018?
I saw the first show that David Byrne did on his this new tour that he's been doing with the, if you haven't seen it.
You saw the tour opener.
Yeah, the tour opener, which was in Red Bank, New Jersey. And it was just, I mean, it blew me away. I don't want to spoil it for anyone who hasn't seen it, but it's just an amazing, amazing show. A lot of Talking Heads tunes, which was a surprise, very welcome surprise. I went to Newport Folk Festival as well, which is consistently one of the best musical experiences of my year when I do manage to go. So that was a highlight.
Certainly a festival I've been wanting to go to.
Oh yeah, yeah. In 2008 was the first year they brought in a new guy to book the talent, and he sort of. The festival was broke, basically, and he came in and realized, you know, if we start bringing in some of these like folk adjacent you know, bands, like Wilco is sort of like the best example of that kind of a band that does, like, you know, a lot of their stuff is related to folk, but is you know, definitely not like old school. Yeah, it's not Pete Seeger, exactly. But that's the thing that's really cool.
What about the kid?
What'd you say, Brian?
What do all the kids who called Dylan Judas have to say about that?
I mean, the fun thing is that there's still a lot of old school, you know, guys standing around a single mic with acoustic guitars and banjos and mandolins at Newport every year. So that's still very much part of it.
So I know that you've got a new podcast in the works. You're joining the growing Fish Fan podcast group that we've all got going here. You think you're doing it with Mike Hamad? You want to tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, sure. So we are. So the podcast is called Jamsplaining, which is very much intended to be tongue in cheek. it's, you're right. It's me. Thanks. Yeah, thank you. So it's me and Mike Hamad, and we are recording episodes right now, and we're going to debut later this fall. And you can follow us on Twitter at Jamsplaining to stay on top of when we do finally end up releasing some episodes. And the idea is that you know, we're both musicologists, which, you know, means we both have PhDs in musicology. And we know from, you know, being on social media that people are really interested in the technical side of the music of Fish and the Dead and other jam bands. You look at the, you know, the anatomy of a jam videos that Amar Guitar on his YouTube channel has been very popular with. So there's,
yes,
there's definitely a sort of, you know, I think a desire amongst Fish fans to know a little bit more about the technical side of music. So we figured, let's have a podcast where instead of just, you know, chatting about Fish, we put our training to work and apply what we've learned as musicologists to improvisational rock music. So that's what we're going to do. And we don't have a schedule yet, but the episodes will be around like 30 minutes or so. There's going to be a lot of music. It'll be a little conversational. It'll be a little educational. It's definitely going to be technical. And like I said, follow us at Jamsplaining. And you should be able to also find us on Facebook to find out more.
Once again, where can we find you on Twitter? One last time.
For the podcast, it's going to be at Jamsplaining, and you can follow me personally at Smooth Atonal Sound SND.
All right. And on that note, let's get to the Fish.
Right, so why are we talking about September 14th, 1999, AC/DC Bad? Well, if you have not heard this jam, turn off everything, even this podcast, and go and listen to this jam in full. It's 27 minutes of absolute 99 bliss. It is one of the most accomplished, one of the most seamless, one of the most melodic and varied jams that the band has ever played. It's one of my favorite jams, as I said at the top of the show, and we're very excited to be talking about this jam. It's an absolutely incredible achievement for the band overall. Jake, as our guest, why did you want to talk about this jam?
I think you kind of hit it when you said varied. You know, it's so varied. It goes through so many different jam phases, and we're going to listen to two of the jam segments, you know, two of the sort of improvisational episodes, but it's got a couple other that we're not even going to talk about. It's got a big sort of peaky, soaring, psychedelic jam. It's got a fast kind of arena rock jam. And then the last like 6 minutes or so of it are like this weird, twitchy, digital sound effects, vacuum-assisted, you know, ambient space, which is really unlike most sort of spacey jams that Phish has ever played.
Yeah, it's like, it's really of a time and a place, but it's also to me like, this is that connective tissue between 1997, 1999, and 2000. For me, so I was given three tapes when I first got into Phish, as I kind of mentioned at the top. We were talking about how you got into Phish. Summer camp was it for me. And an older counselor gave me 11/17/94, 10/7/2000, and 9/14/1999. And just a side note, I don't think I'd ever pass those shows to anyone to get into Phish, but somehow it worked for me. I still love 11/17/94 and 9/14/99. Those are two just like very special shows to me.
10/7/2000.
Yeah,
October 7th. That was like a melancholy show.
Yeah, a really weird show to pass to someone to like get into a band. Like, here's the last show that they ever played. I am like obsessed with like historical dates, so I feel like that might have been part of the reason I was drawn to it as well. But I don't know. This jam, you know, both of those shows, all three of these shows, like this bag is the only real jam out of them, and it really hit me. And proved to me immediately just how seamlessly the band could lock in on a theme, really expand upon it, jam in this very intentional manner as though they were playing previously written music. And when I brought these CDs to college just a short year and a half later, I probably listened to this 1,000 times in my freshman year dorm. I would like invite people off of the floor to listen to it. It just blew me away. It was like the symphony I could not stop listening to. I loved it so much.
Hey man, you got to hear this. You got to hear this. 17
sure you did that completely sober as well.
I'll tell you though, there is nothing to my ears that is as hauntingly beautiful as the first jam segment of this version. It's just that is for me, you know, every other part of this jam, there's other jams that have something maybe a little similar, but there is nothing in the Phish catalog that kind of strikes me the same way that the first part of this jam does. And I'll talk about why I think that is in a little bit, but you know, this is also sort of the last of the big AC/DC bags. There was a sort of monster 3-year run for the song from 97 through 99, where it was a big set to jam vehicle a couple of times. It wasn't frequently, but you know, I mean, there's of course the Hampton 97 and then New Year's 97 and then UIC 98. And then this
Virginia Beach 98.
Yeah. Virginia Beach for sure. Yeah, yes. Yeah. And then the only other time they really took bag out for this kind of a trot was Coventry, actually. Which
Coventry and Woods 04. Those
Great
those
Woods, that's right. Like, yeah.
Randomly stuck in there. I have no idea why, but
I think at that point they were just like they didn't even want to play songs. They just wanted to jam. And it was like, doesn't matter. Right. You know, they just wanted to like, you know, it was like, let's play something so we can get to the jam. And AC/DC bag
a buddy of mine texted easy. Me on buddy of mine texted me on Velvet Night because they opened up the second set with this, and it was just like all exclamation points. And
I thought it was going to happen. Yeah,
I know. I know. When that happened, he texted me. I was like freaking out on my couch, and I love that set. I think that that would have been a perfect place to bring that back. Then
I turned to my crew. We were on the floor that night, and I was like, "This is it. This is gonna be the monster set two opening AC/DC bag. Like, it's happening." And then it didn't. But I mean, yeah. That Wolfman's is that's my that the minute 12 of that Wolfman's from Red Velvet Night is my favorite moment of the entire Baker's Dozen. But that's for another episode.
Funny. I have a confession to make in that I actually hadn't heard this jam until it was made alive officially, so a little over like a year ago. Yeah. They played so many shows in 1999. I mean, there's a lot to catch up on. I mean, it's kind of mind-blowing to me that I was able to see the band in Long Island in October, like 10-7 and 10-8-99. That's when the Mets were in the playoffs. And then 2 months later, I could see them in Philadelphia being 12-10 and 12-11. I mean, that's never going to happen again, where they basically they do a whole run and they take like a few weeks off and do like a whole like concluding run, both in like the Northeast.
They mm-hmm. they played three full tours in 6 months. It's totally unprecedented in post 1996 Phish. It's wild. Or post 1995. It's like, yeah, I'm blown away constantly when I look at how many shows happened in 1999, because just a year later they'd go on a hiatus and then they'd play like very, very sparingly. So speaking of that, in terms of like this show, where it falls in this tour, we've talked about late fall 1999. We haven't really talked about early fall 1999 in this podcast. And so it's an interesting start to the tour. They kick things off in Vancouver, which
it's weird.
Was this the last time that they played in Vancouver?
Yeah, they've played in Canada before. I think this is the last time they played. Right, last time they played in Vancouver. And that show, the 9999 show, in addition to having like the first Mozambique, I think it was
one of two Mozambiques.
Right, yeah, right, one or two. There were like some other tab songs that opened that show. That show has one of the most underrated, unheralded Madness tweezers. I mean, despite being a tour opener, usually in 3.0, a tour opener means kind of like a bit of like a tentative slop fest. But Jesus Christ, this tweezer. This could be...
I don't know if... I've never heard that tweezer, actually.
So. Oh, it gets insane. It's nice. Just throwing all kinds of shit at the wall. And it's like the Michael Bay of tweezers. You're just hired to blow shit up. So, maybe... Nice. Maybe a future Beyond the Pond pick. But anyway.
And then the fall Gorge shows, which must have been gorgeous during the day and absolutely freezing at night, I'm sure. But
yeah, that's bizarre. They played the Gorge in September.
Yeah. And then they go to Portland for the Sunday. And they did four nights in a row. Vancouver, Gorge, Portland, Thursday through Sunday. And then the next Thursday was in Shoreline, which was that show where Phil came out and jumped on the trampolines. And the Tuesday in between Portland, Oregon and Shoreline, and if you look at a map, you'll see why this is crazy, was in Boise. And, you know, it's like, this is your classic sleeper show. It was undersold. It was a Tuesday. It was wicked out of the way for anyone who was on tour. You know, really the only reason you would have gone to this show is if you lived in Montana or Idaho, or maybe you were coming back from those Pacific Northwest shows. If you were driving back east, maybe you would have included it. But, I've heard from a number of people who, you know, were miraculously there that, this was like, you know, it was way undersold and like it was a GA floor and a GA stands, and I think that like the stands had zero people. It was just the floor, basically.
I met a guy in college who was at this show, who it was his only Phish show, and he had no idea. He was like, "Yeah, I saw them once in Boise," and I was like, "When?" And it was one of those weird moments where you're like, "This person's gonna think it's really weird if I say 9/14/99."
Yeah, I had a similar encounter with a guy at a conference, a scholar from Prague, who was like, "Oh yeah, I saw fish once in Prague in 1998," and I was like, "July 6th."
You're like, I'm trying to keep it cool here, but were you really at the show? And he was like, "Yeah, it was a good show. It was a fun concert." And I was like, "No." But it's like getting angry at his joy of just like liking the concert, because I was like, "No, you have to understand, this was." But it's a really interesting start to the tour, and I mean, they haven't played Idaho since then. They'll give us Tahoe and Bend, I guess, once, and the Gorge, and they played Eugene and Seattle. Like, they very sparingly go to the Pacific Northwest. As someone who resided in Portland for almost 2 years during 3.0, I can attest to how frustrating that is, because there's a lot of fans there.
Well, there's a lot of craft beer. There's a lot of fish fans.
Right. But so following this show, they go to Shoreline. Phil Lesh is there. 9/18/99, another Fall 99 live fish release. Phenomenal 20-minute Boogie On that's not totally dissimilar to The Bag, but it also showcases the overall diversity in the tour. I feel like if there's ever a complaint about 99, it's that the band started to be really sloppy and that their jams were like very millennial sounding and kind of airy and ambient. And I love how much they just do with that type of sound. It never feels like a crutch that they're falling back on.
I feel like in retrospect, people have been much more praising of 1999 Fish than they were at the time, which is not surprising, but sort of with the backwards glance that hindsight gives us, like, you can see its role in the sort of evolution of the band's sound. And people have, I mean, I feel like every time Shapiro releases another, you know, from the archives, people are like, more 99, you know. So
yeah. No, I mean, I totally agree, and there's a lot to choose from, and it's such an interesting year to me, because it is such a clear diversion from 97 and 98, even though it's really connected to those 2 years. But like, there's like a growth there's like another step that they're going through musically. But then,
well, and Trey had you know, written all his Trey tunes, and that was one of the big things, you know, was that, like, you know, he was jamming by laying down these, you know, those loops, the ghost loops, you know, on like Jabu in 99, and just sort of creating this soundscape over which he would then solo, and he brought that to Fish jamming as well, you know. And that's you really hear that influence of the electric tab shows, those trio shows.
I'm realizing it now. I think that 99 is, aside from any 3.0 years, 99 is becoming our most popular year for Beyond the Pond episodes. This is, we've done the Virginia Beach Birds, the Camden Chalk Dust, now this, and the Memphis 2001. It's just super clear how big and how diverse of a year this is, how much there is to pick from. Yeah, I love this year. I love the way that they sound at this fall tour, because you feel like they picked up aspects of, there's that really great show from Japan. I think it's July 31st, 99. You could kind of hear the seeds of what they would do the following June in Japan start to be taking hold. And they were clearly plotting themselves towards the all night show at Big Cypress that was coming up just a few months away. I mean, there's just a lot that they're kind of toying with at this point in time that I just absolutely love.
A lot of patience and a lot of like expansive jamming, really, you know.
Yes. Yeah, just like seeing, you know, really earnestly what's around the next corner. Like, where can this lead us? And, you know, a lot of it comes out of, I totally agree with what you were saying at the top about, you know, how hauntingly beautiful the entry point from AC/DC bag into the jam is, it really sounds unlike anything I've ever heard from Phish. And I feel like you had a lot of those moments in 1999 where they'd play a jam and you were like, I've honestly never heard the band play in any style like this.
Yeah. On that note, I think we need to listen to some of the AC/DC bag from September 14th, 1999. We'll be right back.
So that whole segment of AC/DC bag is just, like I was saying, you know, hauntingly beautiful. And for me, I mean, so what's actually happening there is that, you know, and the reason it sounds so familiar but sort of dark is because Fish is playing the chords to AC/DC bag, the regular sort of chorus chords or the jam chords, but they are playing them in the minor key, in the minor mode, instead of major key. So for those of you who don't know, the chords to AC/DC bag are A, C, D, C, F, A, G. And for obvious reasons, they changed the name to bag. And those are all major chords. And all they do, and this happens right at the very beginning of that jam, Mike just plays an A and then a C instead of a C sharp. And that one little note difference, that one pitch difference, just changes the entire landscape of the jam. And instead of all major chords, you get A minor, C major, D major, C major, F, A minor, G. And that one change to A minor is what just like throws this whole thing into this sort of dark psychedelic dreamscape. And it got me thinking about, you know, other times that people or, you know, musicians or composers have taken a very familiar melody and all they've done is just changed it into the minor key and it changes everything. And the most sort of famous example of this from history is Gustav Mahler, the Viennese composer from right at the end of the 19th and beginning of the 20th century. In his first symphony, the third movement, he takes the Frère Jacques melody, which, you know, everybody knows, you know, Frère Jacques, Frère Jacques. And he plays it in the minor mode. And again, it's just a tiny melodic adjustment. Just one note goes down a little bit, but it immediately affects the entire mood. So instead of da, 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 it's da, 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 da. And that instantly just turns it into this sort of funeral march. And he adds a beat to it, like this sort of funeral march beat, and he plays it with the low instruments, so the double bass, the bassoon, and the cellos. And he actually imagined that this movement was like a funeral procession for forest animals, which is a really sort of dark but playful kind of, you know, very psychedelic kind of image, I think. And you know, he adds these counter melodies and there's all this complexity and it further sort of deepens this sense of dreaminess. And to say that it's psychedelic is not that far of a leap, because the Vienna that Mahler lived in was a kind of a hedonistic place and people were ingesting all kinds of substances and they were thinking about dream states. You know, this is when Sigmund Freud was really, you know, coming up in the world of psychoanalysis and inventing psychoanalysis. And so when you hear this, you're going to hear this familiar melody, just like that AC/DC bag jam, but you're going to hear it in a very sort of dark and dreary and eerie kind of setting. And we're going to listen to probably the classic Mahler symphonic recording, which is Leonard Bernstein conducting the New York Philharmonic. So this is Mahler's first symphony, the beginning of the third movement. Thank you. So the other, you know, so that is sort of the reason, the first thing I thought of when I heard this jam and thought about what it reminds me of was this whole fact that the AC/DC bag is playing in the wrong, or not the wrong, but in a different key, or in the same key, but just in the minor key. But the other thing that I hear a ton of in this jam, and I think if it was just a minor version of AC/DC bag, it would be good, but not great. But what really kicks this segment into the next level is the sort of resplendent, shimmering, psychedelic quality of the sound of the jam, especially Trey's guitar a few minutes into it when he kicks in the envelope filters and just gives it this amazing sort of watery, hazy reverb. And, you know, it instantly brought to mind the Cure's Disintegration album, which, you know, throughout the entire album just has that same kind of, you know, hazy reverb, those watery envelope filters, big sort of synthesizer sounds. The guitar is very heavily affected. And especially the opening of the song Last Dance, which really reminds me of this section of the bag jam. There's the sort of sparse drums, this big expansive sound, and these watery guitar effects on the leads. And like the AC/DC bag, it's in a minor key and it's sort of dark and has this wild dreamscape quality to it.
Yeah, just to that note, I think Disintegration came out in 1989, I think.
Yep.
Okay. Yeah, the big singles off that record were Pictures of You and Love Song. Both of which, while great, neither really captured the spirit of that record, which, like you're saying, is much more droney and psychedelic and, frankly, weird in a good way.
Yeah. You know? And Robert Smith was self-medicating with LSD for much of the writing and recording of that album.
Okay, I believe that. Yeah. I know.
I believe that.
The opening song on the record, Plain Song, that's a really good example of shoegaze, which we talk about all the time in love.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. The other single, Fascination Street, has that incredible Simon Gallup bass line, which is like three notes, just him going, da-dun, 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 ga-gun, 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 ga-gun,
mm-hmm.
right at the whole song. And it's just... it's foreboding and it's awesome. So, and if you're looking to get into the Cure, that album is way more psychedelic and less frenetic post-punk than the early stuff. I think the one that came after it, Wish, that was one of their bigger...
Popular.
That was one of the bigger MTV albums that had Friday I'm in Love.
Right.
But it's also got big dramatic windswept epics like From the Edge of the Great Dean, From the Edge of the Deep Green Sea. And if you ever have a chance to see The Cure live, especially for Fish fans, do it, because they play like for 3 hours. I mean, they'll play like 35 songs in 3 hours, but they're I've seen them twice. They're very, very good live. And on that note, let's listen to some Last Dance from The Cure.
Thank you, Jake and Dave, for breaking down that first segment there, Familiar Themes in a Minor Key. So jumping into new album recommendations. So as of time of recording, I have not stopped listening to this record, and I've probably listened to it 10 times to this point in time, just in a matter of days. When this episode is released, I do sincerely hope that this is still true. I imagine this is still true, because right now, this is probably my favorite record of 2018. So this is Jeff the Brotherhood's Magic Songs. For those of you who don't know the band, it's two brothers from Nashville, Jake and Jamin Oral. They can be categorized in a number of different ways. I mean, their sound is kind of, it just kind of defies categorization, but you could say they have elements of psych, garage rock, punk, pop, even just general rock. They're guitar, drums, effects, there's some psychedelic noise in it. It's stuff that any one of our listeners is going to love. This duo started releasing records around 2001 while they were still in high school. And while they received critical acclaim in Nashville, they really weren't widely listened to until a later age. They released EPs with Ty Segall, Best Coast, and Screaming Females. And in 2012, the record Hypnotic Nights was produced by Dan Auerbach and was recorded in a single week. This new record, Magic Songs, is really well produced, but it's still really kind of feels lo-fi in its production, but like it works for it really, really well. There's just beautiful melodies and guitar lines and kind of psychedelic noise that comes in and immerses into each song at like a very slow building pace. The lyrics will like kind of feel like they're coming like flying by, like you're just traveling down the road. They come at you and then they're gone. Guitar chords throughout here, the rhythms are just phenomenal. And the flow of the overall record is, I would say from a flow standpoint, from just like pressing start on a record and listening all the way through, it's probably my favorite of the entire year in that standpoint. I cannot recommend this record enough. I am texting Dave every 5-10 minutes with a new song he needs to listen to from this record. It's really that great. Jeff the Brotherhood, Magic Songs. I encourage every one of our listeners to be listening to this. Dave, what do you got?
Yeah, Brian, I will back you up on that Jeff the Brotherhood album. It sounds, I was a big fan of Hypnotic Nights from 2012, which you mentioned, but that album basically just sounds like Hesher's covering Weezer's Blue album. And this new one sounds absolutely nothing like that. It kind of reminded me a lot of the Flaming Lips album Embryonic from a few years ago. So I would recommend that highly as well. The album I'm going to talk about is the third album from a Philadelphia band called, they're called Nothing. They're on Twitter at Nothing the Band. So we talk a lot about shoegaze on Beyond the Pond. And these guys, they are led by a dude named Dominic Palermo. He actually had his roots in a hardcore band called Horror Show. But now he's doing the heavy shoegaze thing, and it kind of sounds a lot like Smashing Pumpkins at points, just thick layers of guitar with Palermo's dreamy vocals. I know he said he's been heavily influenced by The Cure, heavily influenced by My Bloody Valentine. And in terms of sort of not the lighter side of shoegaze, but the more heavier, skull-crushing, and yet at times poppy, it's one of the better records I've heard in a very long time. I mean, they've always had, from their first record, which I think came out, I want to say 4 years ago, called Guilty of Everything, they've always had the sound, but a little deficient in the songwriting department. They had an album that came out in 2016 that had improved on that, but the most recent one, it's like the songwriting has finally caught up with the sound. And in addition to being like, you know, some excellent shoegaze, dream pop heaviness, the songs are quite memorable as well. Certainly, I don't know if it was, I think the first single was the opening track, Zero Day, which I think is actually one of the weaker songs on the record. But then you get something like Blue Line Baby, which I'm obsessed with. And the next song, You Wind Me Up, that could be like a crossover pop hit. It's just, very well done. And if you're a fan of the genre, I would recommend you check them out as soon as possible. Jake, what do you got?
Well, those are both excellent recommendations, neither of which I have heard or heard of. I'm going to take it in a little different direction with an album that was actually released last year in 2017, but just came into my came across my desk, as it were, this year. And this is a band called This Is The Kit. Yeah, so it's the This Is The Kit. It's the alias of the lead singer and songwriter, whose name is Kate Stables. And she's British, and she, I guess the best way to describe her would be she's a folk singer, songwriter, but there is just such a sort of quirky, fascinating quality to her songwriting, and this unbelievably just sort of gentle tone to her vocal quality that is very peaceful and relaxing. She sort of has that British folk singer quality where it's a little cleaner and a little bit more classical in a way than like the American folk singers, which tend to be a little more maybe nasal or twangy and sort of have more of that like Americana, sort of country influence. But her music is somewhere between kind of, you know, indie rock and folk. She plays the banjo on stage as well as guitar, but a lot of her songs are banjo led. And she sort of does like she doesn't play the banjo in a conventional American, you know, sort of bluegrass style, like Clawhammer or Flat and Scruggs style at all. She sort of plays it almost like an acoustic guitar with arpeggios and finger picking. And one of the coolest things about her songs is they have a lot of really interesting kind of rhythmic tricks and complexities to them. There's a song on that album. So the album is called Moonshine Freeze. I don't think I mentioned that. So This Is The Kit, Moonshine Freeze from 2017. And the title track, Moonshine Freeze, has this really interesting kind of herky-jerky combination of different rhythms that sound like they're not right, but they fit together perfectly. She's got a couple of songs that are a little bit harder, a little more sort of rock edged. One is called Hotter Colder. She's got one called All Written Out Numbers, which is both songs I love. And then she's got some really gentle sort of pensive songs like Empty No Teeth and Bulletproof that are just gorgeous. So I would say you probably have to be a little bit predisposed to liking sort of singer-songwriter folky music. It's not something that if you're just like rock or jam bands, you're gonna like listen to this and be like, oh, I love this. But maybe it's a good sort of gateway drug into the world of folk music.
Yeah, I saw them open up for the National about 10 months ago, and I can definitely back up everything you're saying. It was very hauntingly beautiful, and I loved how the rhythms of her songs just kind of like bounced around in a really unique way, kind of always kept me on my toes. So I would definitely, I'd back you up. I'd recommend this record to any one of our listeners, especially, you know, I mean, we've definitely featured our fair share of singer-songwriter folk music on this podcast. And I would say that this definitely falls in line with some of the best of that stuff.
All right.
So we listened to that first jam, which was gorgeous. And then it goes into a sort of improvisational space that is a lot more familiar to many of us. It's sort of this soaring, peaky, psychedelic jam. Sounds, you know, it's gorgeous. It's an amazing jam. It's very unique. Actually, I should say it's an amazing jam, but it's not very unique for that time period. You know, it sounds like a lot of the other sort of floaty, soaring, peaky psychedelic jams from 97, 98, 99. And then it gets into this sort of punchy rock jam, which, almost at times reminds me of like some of the best, you know, some of the fun parts of the Camden Chalk Dust from that summer. Like not the glory hole part, but the parts that lead into it. And then this is just like a big fat disco dance party, and I just love it. So
yeah, it's amazing how far astray we get from 5 minutes into this jam, that they've built this up into, I think at some point around this point of the jam, there was a tortilla war, not a glow stick war. There were tortillas flying.
That's very Pacific Northwest-y.
Yeah, and there's a full video of this jam on YouTube, which is really good quality, and you can see the tortillas. One of the first things I remember ever hearing about Phish was, there's a point, I don't know exactly where it is within this jam, but I think it's in this segment, where Mike's bass goes up so much louder than everyone else. And apparently, as I've been told, and this may be hearsay, a tortilla hit the soundboard and like hit Mike's levels up a bit. And Paul actually picked up the tortilla, tossed it back to the crowd, and adjusted it. And if you hear, there's a segment in this whole part of the jam where Mike's bass just like explodes. And I don't know if it's true. I've always loved the lore of that.
Yeah. Whether it's true or not, it's an awesome story.
So let's listen to a little bit of this. I guess we would say, just from a timing standpoint, that this is kind of where the jam starts to pick up, build, and it's going to lead to its eventual ambient conclusion.
Yeah, this is the sort of last jam before the ambient space at the end. And it's got some start-stop too, so don't be fooled by the lack of woos there. You're not supposed to woo. So the, you know, as far as, you know, there's so many obviously disco songs that you could talk about with reference to this section of the jam, but the thing that I think really sort of defines this jam for me is not just that Fishman has the sort of four on the floor, or not a true four on the floor, because I don't think he's capable of doing that, but you know, the sort of hi-hat on the beat and just you know, steady sort of disco beat. The thing that really sort of strikes me about this is the punchy kind of guitar strums that lead the jam. They're sort of, Trey is strumming on the beat. He's kind of doing this like ba 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 ba, and it gives it this sort of funky retro 70s sound, but it's guitar led, and it reminded me a lot of this band called Escort, which is a band from not from the 70s, but from this decade and the previous one. And their 2007 song All Through the Night, which is just a fun disco tune. It's got horns, it's got you know, vocals, so in a lot of ways it's different than this jam, but it does have that sort of guitar strumming to lead the beat, and just the, you know, the singers, I just like imagine like glitter jumpsuits and big, like, you know, like 1975 Cher singing this basically, so, or Donna Summer or something. So
give it to me, say it to me, work it with me, if you're ready I'm about to pop.
Song, this is interesting. The album I'm going to talk about is called The Glow of Love by the band Change, which came out in 1980. And to be perfectly honest, I hadn't listened to this album until this week, because I read about it in the recent Pitchfork Top 200 of the 1980s. And while generally once you get around to the top 50, 60, I've heard all those records, those lists are lots of fun because there's lots of stuff in, like, you know, the 180s, 170s, 190s that you haven't heard of or just hadn't thought of, because usually the critics and contributors that they get to that thing are pretty hardcore nerds, which I can appreciate. So this record, I think when it came out, they were kind of derided as being a poor man chic or like B-game chic, because they definitely do sound a lot like the Nile Rodgers band, in the sense that they're a largely funky ensemble, lots of popping bass, lots of click guitar, lots of four on the floor dance beats. And the seven songs are on this record, they're catchy and they're incredibly good. And also, I think about half the album features the vocals of Luther Vandross before he was Luther Vandross. I know, I think some of his earliest stuff, you can actually hear him doing the backing vocals on David Bowie's Young Americans record, but he really gets to step out, especially on the title track of this album, which is really something to behold. And the first song, A Lover's Holiday, I think that's, I actually had heard that song before. I didn't know it was by Change. Like, I've certainly heard that in like some golden oldie stations. And also, for people who like the Happy Mondays, the song on the Pills and Thrills and Bellyaches album called Holiday just completely rips the chorus off of the Change song. And they do it, and I'm pretty sure they don't even credit them with it, because that was what the Happy Mondays like to do. But yeah, in terms of just the, I mean, we listened to this record yesterday in the car, actually driving to get groceries. My wife said, "How on earth did this come out in the 1980s? I said, "Well, it came out in 1980. She said, "Oh." Because at that point, you know, the 70s hadn't really... It takes a few years of the transitions. Like, I still say that the 90s didn't become the 90s until, like, Nirvana broke in 1992. And in 1980, you could still probably, the influences of, like, the late 70s, 77 or such were still there. So...
Well, and it's Europe too. I mean, the disco and club scene in Europe is totally on a different sort of time scale than, right? Because you said this was an Italian record, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Half of it was made, it's all in English, but I think they said half of it was made in Bologna and half of it was made in the States. And I think.
I mean, I'm sure that this was killing it at clubs in, you know, Berlin and throughout Europe for years after it was no longer cool to listen to this sort of thing in the States.
Yeah, it's got the very Giorgio Moroder sequencer type groove going on, especially in the second to last. Actually, I guess like the proper closer is a song called The End, which, I mean, that sounds like a Giorgio Moroder, like Donna Summer style, like instrumental straight up. Like the last song is actually, it's a remix of a prior song on the album. And the remix is better than the original, in my opinion.
Would it have taken until Random Access Memories for most American listeners to really appreciate this kind of music?
May have taken Random Access Memories to kind of maybe get it back into the consciousness. But yeah, this is definitely taking from that era of music. Absolutely, that like late 70s, early 80s plastic disco, like also like Steely Dan Gaucho era, that Random Access Memories make cool again.
It's funny that Fish plays this so unabashedly, and I mean, not this, not a cover, but like in this style, in such a way that kind of just goes over so many listeners' heads in a lot of senses.
And I mean, Page, the synth sound that Page drops, that big sort of synthesizer swoop, you know, that comes in, is like, I mean, that's a very unique sound from Page at that time, I always, to my mind, and anybody who grew up in the Boston area and is like maybe 25 or older might recognize this, but it sounds just like the WGBH logo music that would always play on the Boston PBS station. If you don't know it, look it up. I don't know if you guys are going to throw it on there, but just Google WGBH logo 70s and you'll hear what I mean. Page does this rising synthesizer thing that is totally, just like unique for, pretty much any era of Fish.
Yeah, and Page over the last 2 years with his synthesizers. I mean, you talk about that, Jake, with what he was playing here in this segment of the jam. That's like a 2017, 2018 Page. You don't really get that type of synthesizer sound out of him 20 years ago.
That's that Baker's Dozen, the new keyboard tech influence. That's what it sounds like to me,
Right. Yeah. No, I'm right there with you.
But in 1999.
So should we play a little bit of
yeah, let's listen to the title track, Change. Glow of Love.
Thank you. pleasure when you treasure all that's new and true and gay. Easy living and we're giving what we know we're dreaming of. We are one having fun walking in the glow of love. All right,
guys, thank you so much for hanging out with us here in episode 45, where we talked about the AC/DC bag from Boise, Idaho. So just a quick recap of the songs that we played here today. So in segment one, focusing on familiar themes in the minor key, we had Mahler's First Symphony, the third movement, as well as The Cure's Last Dance. In segment two, big fat disco dance parties. Jake talked about Escorts All Through the Night. And Dave talked about Change the Glow of Love.
So just a reminder of our social media links. You can find us on Twitter and @_beyondthepond, one word, Simplecast. The website is beyondthepond.simplecast.fm. Of course, on Spotify, we have our Beyond the Pond podcast song that has all the songs we've had in every episode of Beyond the Pond. Right now, it's at 318 songs, getting kind of unwieldy. We invite you to check out the other Osiris podcasts, which can all be found at osirispod.com. That's osirispod.com. And leave us an iTunes review, because we read them. And the more reviews we get, the kind of increases our standing in terms of the iTunes algorithm. And that's a good thing.
Absolutely. And from a publishing standpoint, so you guys saw us actually stick to our word here and every 2 weeks get an episode. That's going to increase dramatically here over the next couple of weeks as Phish goes back on tour for their fall tour. We'll be reviewing episodes as they will probably be taking the tour in like 3 or 4 show chunks. So keep an eye out for a bunch of episodes from us over the next month or so here. But we really appreciate you guys coming out here for this episode, and really want to send a thanks to our guest here, Jake Cohen. Thanks for hanging with us today. This was a lot of fun, really great stuff you brought to the table.
Yeah. Thanks so much for having me, guys. It was a lot of fun to talk shop and play some classical music for everyone.
Absolutely. And
definitely
tell everyone once again the info on your new podcast with Mike Ahmad.
Yeah, sure. So Jamsplaining with me and Mike Hammett, and it's going to be you can look for us. We don't have a schedule. We don't have episodes yet, but they're coming soon. And follow us on Twitter @Jamsplaining, which is like explaining but jam instead of X. You can also find us on Facebook, and we'll be posting info about our first episode, which will be sometime this fall, on those social media sites. So stay tuned for that. And you can follow me on at @smoothatonalsnd as well.
I am very much looking forward to that podcast coming out. And Jake, thanks for joining us. I know we've wanted to do this for a while, and I'm happy that we've finally had an opportunity to. And on that note, as we always like to say on Beyond the Pond, it's harder than ever to make an honest buck in the music industry. So streaming is one thing, but if you like the bands that you've heard, we really encourage you to go see them live, buy a vinyl, buy some merchandise, just do something to throw some extra bucks their way.
Support your local orchestra.
Yes, that as well. By all means, support your local orchestra. And at this point, if you've made it this far in the podcast, Brian, Jake, and myself, we thank you. And come back in 2 weeks. We will hold hands. Maybe we'll sing Kumbaya. We'll definitely listen to some non-jam bands. Maybe some Italo disco. Maybe some late 80s psychedelia. I don't know. One thing we're guaranteed to do. is Go Beyond the Pond.
Smiling faces, going places. It's a wonder, it's so clear. By a fountain, climbing mountains as we hold each other near. Sipping wine, we try to find that special magic from above as we share our affair, talking in the glow of love.
Osiris.